Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Tom Butler.
And I'm Brendan Duffy.
You're listening to the James Bond A to Z podcast.
Join us on this journey of discovery across the world of the 007 movies as we take an encyclopedic look at cinema's greatest spy films.
We'll learn about the people who made them in front of the camera and behind, from Ken Adam to Mac Zorin, with the occasional detour down a few rabbit holes. And we'll sometimes be joined by guests with unique insight into the world of Bond.
This podcast is in no way affiliated with the James Bond brand, Eon, or the Fleming Estate. We do our best to make sure the information is accurate, but sometimes we do get it wrong. If you want to correct us on something or add some more detail, email us on podcast@jamesbondatoz.co.uk.
Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoy the show. Hello and welcome to the James Bond A to Z podcast, where we have reached the letter Q. My name is Tom Butler, and making his chaotic return to the show to explore the 17th letter of the James Bond world, it's the quirky yet quintessential Mr. Brendan Duffy.
Hello, you don't make it easy for yourself, do you?
And back by popular demand, it's the quizzical and eminently quotable Mr. Mark Harrison.
Hiya Tom, quirking and quivering with excitement to be here.
Exactly.
That was a bit much, but it began with Q.
Exactly. As you would expect, this episode is going to be dominated by the character and gadgets of Q. If you're here for the Quarrel banter, we covered Quarrel and Quarrel Jr. In our previous episodes on Dr. No and Live and Let Die, so you can return to those episodes if you do want more of your Q fix. Just before we kick off, you all know, we're looking for your underappreciated James Bond movie moments for our upcoming 60th anniversary episode. So if you want to get involved, and I do urge that you do, record an audio clip using your phone, telling us who you are, what your underappreciated James Bond movie moment is, and why you love it, and send it to us on podcast@jamesbondatoz.co.uk. And if you send us an entry, we've had a few decent ones already. If you send us one, I'll send you a sticker in return. So how's that for a deal?
Sounds like a great deal. They should get inspired by this episode as well, to be honest.
There are lots of great moments, yeah. So, now, friend of the show, John Cork, in the James Bond Encyclopedia, he says, King Arthur had Merlin, James Bond had Q. With Major Boothroyd, 007 does not need magic spells to accomplish a mission. So I think that's quite an apt way of summing up Q. What do you think?
Yeah, it's beautifully put. It's the Merlin thing, especially. Yeah. Is something or other, isn't it? It's a Kingsman that has, like, the version of Q is just called Merlin as well, straightforwardly.
That's right. Yeah, I've forgotten about that. Yeah. And Desmond Llewellyn, obviously. I mean, he's the one that everyone thinks of when they think of Q. He casts a huge shadow over the series. What is it, 17 appearances?
Yeah.
Something like
17.
That.
And really just a staple of the franchise, wasn't he?
Yeah, one of the few people that sort of carried on from the old regime to the new regime. Sadly missed, of course. But let's kick things off by looking at where the character of Q came from.
Yeah, so Ian Fleming, creator of James Bond, of course, was, before he was an author, was involved in British intelligence operations, involved in the Special Operations Executive, in particular during World War II, so espionage and that kind of thing. And in his experience there are three key figures who are kind of built as the inspiration for Q, as we know him, as in the films, the Quartermaster, who gives Bond all of his various gadgets, etc. Kind of starts out in the very first film just kind of as an armourer, and then just over time grows into this character who comes out with, obviously the movies kind of amp it up as well. But as I say, three figures from Fleming's time in Special Operations Executive that influenced. The key one is Charles Fraser Smith, who's an author who was born in 1904 and during the war worked for the Ministry of Supply during World War II. The Ministry of Supply being the closest thing the closest counterpart in real life to Q Branch, as it became known in the Bond books and films. Fraser Smith came from modest beginnings. He was orphaned at the age of 7 and adopted by a family of Christian missionaries who brought him up in Hertfordshire. The school report at the time that said he was scholastically useless, except for woodwork and science and making things. except for woodwork, science, and making things. I don't know about yous, but I'm not as good at that. But I wouldn't be as. It would hardly be useless in his later career. But after leaving school, he worked in a variety of different professions. He worked as a teacher, as a motorcycle messenger, as an aircraft factory worker, and then had a spell as a Christian missionary influenced by his family in Morocco. When he returned to England in 1939, he gave a Sunday sermon at a church in Leeds where he described his knack for bricolage, the art of making things from whatever happens to be available, which he used while he was overseas. At that sermon, he was recruited for what he called a funny job in London by two men from the Ministry of Supply. Funny job in London being, yeah. So recruited by two men from the Ministry of Supply who were impressed by the sermon and wanting to utilise his talents in what would then be the war effort over the next few years. So while his official job was for the Ministry of Textiles, that was a cover for his actual role working for MI6 and the SOE, creating gadgets and devices that would either help agents gather information in occupied Europe or help prisoners of war escape from POW camps. So, for instance, like for agents, he came up with things like miniature cameras hidden inside cigarette lighters with film concealed in toiletries. And that another big part of the war effort was getting escape boxes to prisoners. So it'd be like hairbrushes containing a map and a saw, or steel shoelaces that could be used as a garrote or for cutting other things. Like Fraser Smith would call these gadgets Q devices. He got the idea from Q ships, which were merchant ships that were sent out with heavy arms so that German submarines would surface during the First World War and attack them, and they'd have arms to fire back, sort of to combat the sort of attacks on blockheads and stuff. So Fraser Smith, a huge figure in this. As far as his work with Fleming, in 2022, we just had a film about this. We just had the World War II movie Operation Mincemeat. Have either of you seen that?
I have. I'm reading the book at the moment, actually.
Yeah.
Horrific.
It stars Johnny Flynn as Ian Fleming during his days working for British Intelligence. I don't mind Johnny Flynn, but he was in, I don't know if you remember these, but he was in those Cineworld adverts a few years ago. Now all I can really, every time I hear his name or see his face, I only think is a bit where in those ads where he's sat at a table with a couple, just really obvious third wheel, just time for a tasty debrief. So anyway, on this tasty debrief, Fleming is involved in Operation Mincemeat, which is the scheme distracting the Nazis, drawing them away from Sicily in order to enable an Allied invasion of Europe via the island. This involved planting false documents on a corpse and letting the enemy find it on the shores of Sicily so that they'd think that they'd picked up some intelligence and divert their forces. So in this film, this film version of it, you don't have Fraser Smith as a character. You do have Fleming as a character, and the assorted forces use Q Branch to create a waterproof tube for the documents to make sure they're not destroyed in the water. Fraser Smith's real contribution was the invention of a trunk where the body would be preserved so they could transport it to Sicily, without the need for refrigeration, which was achieved by filling it with dry ice, which then, when it evaporated, took out the oxygen, filled it with CO2, preserved the body. So, you know, instrumental part of that operation, and obviously an influence on Fleming. I mentioned there's two other figures involved in the Ministry of Supply. Christopher Clayton Hutton is another figure who's often cited. He specialised in escape and evasion. And there was a kind of a notion that, you know, when you send in soldiers out in Europe, if you get captured, make every effort to escape. Don't sit out the war. There'd be these ingenious things like creating fabric maps that you could sew into uniforms and stuff, so that you'd have like maps in order to know where you were going. There'd be concealed compasses inside things like safety razors, collar studs, bottle stoppers. It's all about being escape-minded, as they put it. I mentioned Clayton Hutton because one of his things was reversible uniforms, like the one from the pre-titles of Octopussy. As ridiculous as it seems in that pre-title, it's got a precedent. There was reversible uniforms where so the other side would be like a Luftwaffe uniform for escapees. The other figure worth mentioning is Major Jasper Maskelyne, who was a stage magician who invented secret sabotage and The other major figure to mention is Jasper Maskelyne, who was a stage magician who invented secret sabotage and subterfuge devices for MI9. He volunteered his talents in the war effort for camouflage with his devices that he made for his stage acts. There's been official records seem to contradict a lot of his accounts about his contribution to the war effort. That's worth mentioning. But he was demonstrably involved in the escape boxes efforts, and specifically with printing tiny maps on playing cards. So that it's something like if you wet the card, then the map's revealed. So things like that. In terms of the books, Q Branch pops up in the books. First mentioned in Casino Royale, Live and Let Die, referring more to a branch than a person. A quartermaster figure didn't come in until six novels in. This was after a Scottish firearms expert and Ian Fleming fan called Geoffrey Boothroyd wrote to Ian Fleming to say that Bond wasn't using the best firearms available in the books. As tribute and thanks to him, Fleming named the quartermaster in the next book, Dr. No, Major Boothroyd, which was the sixth novel but the first film.
Yeah, it was the first film, and so they included the character of Major Boothroyd, played by Peter Burton. And in this, he does the same thing as the... What was the guy's name? First name? Geoffrey Boothroyd.
Geoffrey Boothroyd.
Yeah, so he basically just does the same thing. He says that Bond's gun isn't good enough, replaces his Beretta with a Walther PPK.
Nice and light, in a lady's handbag. No stopping power.
Any comments, 007?
I disagree, sir. I've used the Beretta for 10 years.
Show him, Armourer.
Walther PPK. 7.65 mil with a delivery like a brick through a plate glass window. Takes a Brausch silencer with very little reduction in muzzle velocity. The American CIA swear by them.
Thank you, Major Boothroyd.
Thank you, sir. Good night, sir.
That's all he does in that film. Played by Peter Burton, who was an English film and TV actor. He also made two uncredited appearances in Bond films as an RAF officer in Thunderball.
Oh, really?
Also a secret agent in Casino Royale 1967. Around at the time of the 60s, 70s, he was in those TV shows, the classics, The Avengers, The Saint, Return of the Saint, UFO. Mm. So just a jobbing actor throughout his career. But really, really short scene. But Bond tries to keep both guns, doesn't he?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, because I think it's the Beretta first, isn't it? That's
the Beretta, yeah. And he tries to take it as well.
Yeah, it's quite the gun plays quite a big part in the books, I seem to remember. And I think Fleming felt quite chastised when this guy approached him, but also recognised that he had more authority on it. And so it's interesting they made it into book and then made it into the film. It sort of becomes part of the history then, doesn't it?
Yeah, because the gun that he gave him became iconic with the character of Bond. So then moving forward onto the next film, the producers actually wanted Peter Burton to reprise the role, but unfortunately he was busy on making another film, so he was unable to do it. Annoyingly for him, the film he was working on never actually got completed. Oh. So that must be quite frustrating for him, especially when you see what happened to the character of Q. Terence Young basically approached who he'd worked with before. He'd worked with Desmond Llewellyn before, and he approached him. And he wanted him to play it with a Welsh accent. And I think I did cover this on From Russia With Love. But Desmond Llewellyn preferred to play him as a toffee-nosed Englishman. And he said, at a risk of losing the part and with silent apologies to my native land, I launched into Q's lines using the worst Welsh accent, followed by the same in English. So basically, he sort of cancelled himself out of getting having to play it in Welsh. So yeah, he makes the appearance at the beginning of From Russia With Love, and it's a fantastic scene, isn't it, when he's explaining the attaché case.
On the side here, flat throwing knife. Press that button there, and out she comes. Inside the case, you'll find an AR-7 folding sniper's rifle, 0.25 caliber, with an infrared telescopic sight. Then, if you pull out these straps, inside of 50 gold sovereigns, 25 in either side. Now, watch very carefully. An ordinary tin of talcum powder, inside a tear gas cartridge. That goes in the case against the side here like that. It's magnetized so it won't fall. Shut the case. Now, normally to open a case like that, you move the catches to the side. If you do, the cartridge will explode in your face. Now, to stop the cartridge exploding, turn the catches horizontally, like that. Then open normally.
Well, yeah, it's part of that film is that, and something that we talk about a lot is how grounded in reality that film seems to be. Mm-hmm. And when you see the attaché case with all the bits and bobs in it, it feels like something very realistic and usable. And that's the beauty of it, isn't it?
Yeah, it's sort of like a big version of the escape boxes, because they would send them out in like cigarette cases and have to cram as much as they could into these little things that the prisoners of war could get hold of. With a briefcase, you've got room for all sorts. You've got room for 50 gold sovereigns, aside from anything else, but for rifle, all of that stuff.
But the great thing is the part it plays in the actual plot as well, because it's a standard issue, so all 00 agents have it. It's integral to the especially the scene on the train, which we bang on about. It's fantastic. In terms of the screen credit, this one just he's credited as Boothroyd, so he's not actually referred to as Q in this one, but he's just introduced as being from Q branch. So moving forward to the next film, Goldfinger, Guy Hamilton, he was the director, and he wanted to change the approach to the way that Q was played. And Desmond Llewellyn said, "Previously, I played Q as a toffee-nosed technician, more than slightly in awe of Bond. Hamilton changed that approach. This man annoys you. He's irritatingly flippant and doesn't treat your gadgets with respect. Deep down, you may envy his charm with women, but remember, you're the teacher." And so that really changed everything, didn't it? And we also talk about Goldfinger as creating that blueprint and changing everything for Bond. And this was another thing. It set up the character of Q to how he would be played moving forward.
"You'll be using this Aston Martin DB5 with modifications. Now, pay attention, please. Reception on the dashboard here. Auto visual, range 150 miles.
Ingenious and useful too. Allow a man to stop off for a quick one en route.
It has not been perfected out of years of patient research entirely for that purpose, 007. And incidentally, we'd appreciate its return, along with all your other equipment. Intact for once when you return from the field.
Oh, you'd be surprised the amount of wear and tear that goes on out there in the field. Anything else?
Well, I won't keep it for more than an hour or so, if you give me your undivided attention. We've installed some rather interesting modifications. Now, this one I'm particularly keen about. You see the gear lever here? Now, if you take the top off, you'll find a little red button. Whatever you do, don't touch it.
No, why not?
Because you'll release this section of the roof and engage and fire the passenger ejector seat.
Ejector seat? You're joking.
I never joke about my work, 007.
Yeah, basically up until I think the Timothy Dalton era, I think it sort of is the template, isn't it? I think it sort of changes a little bit in that era to a more uncle-y type figure. But Terrence Young absolutely nailed it, didn't he? Oh, sorry, Guy Hamilton absolutely nailed it. Like, either by accident or by design, really. Well, as we say in Goldfinger, that's the one that sets the template up for the rest of the film. And that is one of the key parts of that film that continues to this day, really.
Yeah, it's the one with the whole, like, when ejector seat is first moved, it's literally ejector seat, you must be joking. And that becomes a template for ever escalating background nonsense branch in each of these films.
Yeah, because we also see the gas parking meter that gases people, don't we, in that scene as well.
Yeah,
yeah.
And you get the sense of him having his own sort of lab and or workshop or whatever. It all comes together in Goldfinger, doesn't it?
Yeah, and Desmond Llewellyn, it's the first time he really gets to properly play Q. And he does a great job, to be honest. The annoyance of when he says, "I never joke about my work, 007, is you really feel it. So moving forward to Thunderball, We see him in a blue Hawaiian shirt, which has pineapples on it.
Important
iconic. It's just because I noticed it when I watched it at the cinema a couple of months ago. You really notice it on the big screen. Yeah, so this is his first appearance being out on the field, providing Bond with his equipment. You Only Live Twice. Again, he goes out on the field to demonstrate Little Nelly and to supervise the assembly, which is that really weird. It's sort of shot.
It's a time lapse, isn't it?
Time lapse of it being built, yeah.
Yeah.
It's quite jarring. On Her Majesty's Secret Service, of course, that's where Bond gets married. And there's some nice dialogue from Q in that one.
Congratulations, 007. I must confess that I've sometimes thought you a little,
irresponsible?
Exactly. That's exactly the word. Thank you. This time, my boy, I can't complain.
Nor can I.
Look, James, I know that we haven't always exactly seen... Well, anyway, don't forget, if there's anything you ever need...
Thank you, Q, but this time I've got the gadgets. I know how to use them.
And it's sort of the glimpse behind, you know, into the real Q, isn't it? You know, he does have a fondness for Bond.
Yeah, it's softer, it's more friendly, but then by the next film it's Connery back and they're just back to bickering again.
yeah, Connery's back for Diamonds Are Forever, and he's got some pointless gadgets in this one, hasn't he? He's got the voice alteration machine. just pointless. And the gadget that he's been wanting to try out, the ring, the magnetic ring, so he can cheat all the casino machines. Why? Why is he making that?
It's got to be said, like, I adore, in any film, really, I don't think there's any film where it's done badly, I adore Field Q. Like, Desmond Llewellyn getting out there, like, any, like, License to Kill, where he just looks so sad every time. He tells, go home, Q. But then, yeah, in Diamonds Are Forever, just going around and gaming all the machines. Beautiful.
Yeah. I remember in the Diamonds episode that we did, he had a really good time just wandering around the casinos, gambling and seeing all the shows and all that sort of stuff. So you can just tell he just loves being out there, doesn't he? Mm.
So on Live and Let Die, it's the first absence since he started the role. And this was, if you go back to our Live and Let Die episode, this was all because they wanted to sort of step away from, not only step away from the gadgets, but they wanted to step away from Connery's Bond. And so any sort of similarity between the way Connery played Bond was stripped away from this to really distance themselves. So we just get a reference to Q's repaired his watch, the magnetic watch, and there are gadgets, but we don't see him on screen. Desmond Llewellyn actually did make time to be able to be available for this, and he was annoyed that he wasn't involved. But if you go back to the Live and Let Die episode, you can listen for more on that. He was back for The Man with the Golden Gun. And just talking about Roger Moore, he said, of course, I knew Roger and he was great fun to work with. He used to muck about an awful lot and he used to give me extra lines to say that I didn't understand. When I did a close-up, he'd stand there shaking his head as if to say, you're going to forget a line, aren't you? And of course, I immediately would. And he'd shove a big idiot card saying, bollocks, he wasn't very helpful. Classic Roger there. So in Man with the Golden Gun, Q identifies the bullet, which then sort of the plot thickens after that. Spy Love Me, we have the Lotus, which and then he's in his workshop in Egypt, so more Field Q.
It's not quite. Is it this one where it sort of starts with, like, there'll be a format, they'll sort of, like, they'll be in some headquarters out and about, but Q Branch, it'll be like, there'll be some demonstration of something, like, it'll be like a buffet table, and someone puts a sausage in a bun and it explodes, and it goes, very good, have that ready for Her Highness's quinceañera, or something like that. And it's the same for, like, four films in a row.
Yeah, it is this one. Yeah, they start with it, and then it's in Moonraker as well. Where he's in a Brazilian monastery, which is his workshop's. I mean, taking all this across the world.
Logistical nightmare.
It's absolutely crazy. For Your Eyes Only, that's where he tests Smithers' arm cast battering ram in the background, if you remember that.
Yeah. And you've got the dentigraph, haven't you, in For Your Eyes Only?
Yes, well, we'll come on to that, won't we, when we talk about the worst gadgets. Octopussy, field cue again, more field cue, out in India.
I'd like to retract my previous statement that there's no bad field cue. I'd forgotten about two old gadgets on a jolly in the hot air balloon at the end. Yeah, I'd completely forgot about that.
Ah, well, there you go.
Putting his massive hands around the girls at the end, going, oh, go on then, kiss a kiss. He has got massive hands, that's the thing, you know.
Ginormous sausage fingers, yeah.
That's I love a close-up of Q's hands. Yeah, that's... View to a Kill, he identifies the microchip, which then Bond goes on to investigate. The Living Daylights, so a little bit about Timothy. He said, Timothy was different in a way because he was a stage actor, and I was a stage actor years and years ago. I think perhaps there's something in that. I don't know quite what it was, but I got on very well with him. And it's just as well, because moving to the next film, License to Kill, this is field cue. This is pure this field cue.
Pinnacle.
Pinnacle. Field uncle, this is, isn't it? Yeah. Yeah, so with Bond quitting, Q has some holiday to take, and he decides to go and help Bond.
This is how he spends it.
I imagine he hasn't been on holiday for the last 40 years, and this is he's earned a week off, and this is what he does.
Go help Bond.
I know exactly what you're up to, and quite frankly, you're going to need my help. Remember, if it hadn't been for Q Branch, you'd have been dead long ago.
It is a thing of like as much as you can sort of split. You know, the first era from the second era, if you like, at the start of Dalton and trying to take it back to Fleming a little bit. Like, he's a legacy character, isn't he, in those Dalton and Brosnan ones. He's not really, like, a peer like he is of Connery and Moore. And he does have it's the uncle status, literally, in License to Kill. But I think he's brilliant with Dalton and with Brosnan, especially.
Yeah.
There's definitely an affection there, isn't there, between the two of them. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And License to Kill was actually his favourite as well. He said, yeah, License to Kill, because I had the biggest part in it. That was wonderful. And he normally only shoots for 2 or 3 days. And obviously he got a lot longer on this one. So, yeah, it was his favourite and he was very fond of being involved with it. Moving to GoldenEye, he said, I was very, very lucky after a long gap when Pierce took over. Everyone went, but they kept me on. I said I was very grateful and everything like that. But I said I ought to have an assistant because as much as I'd like to, I can't go on forever. Of course, we see that 2 films later. He said, Pierce is marvellous. He sort of looks after me and treats me rather like old granddad. So he's very helpful and kind, and he's marvellous to work with. That comes across on screen as well. You know, you can't hide that. You can see it. So in GoldenEye, we see him in his wheelchair with his cast on, which is...
the second cast-based gadget.
Yeah, well, they're running out of ideas now, aren't they? It's been going for 30 years. Yeah, Tomorrow Never Dies. It's field cue again. More field cue. but this time he's playing a car rental salesman.
If you just sign here, Mr. Bond. It's the insurance damage waiver for your beautiful new car. Will you need collision coverage?
Yes.
Fire?
Probably.
Property destruction?
Definitely.
Personal injury?
I hope not, but accidents do happen.
They frequently do with you.
Well, that takes care of the normal wear and tear. Do I need any other protection?
Only from B007, unless you bring that car back in pristine order.
He's sort of shooting the teaser trailer in the film, isn't he? It's really like, well, you need personal injury cover, cut to like a lot of shots of action. Probably, you know, it's brilliant that they set that up and it's just in there.
He said about this, he said, being an old man, for me, there was too much action. It went on and on and on and on. But the young people love it. The more action, the more noise in the film, the happier they are. In the old films, you had pistols and machine guns. In the new films, you have hundreds of those blasting away. The last film, I thought, was incredibly noisy. Scathing. And then in The World Is Not Enough, his final appearance, which Bond doesn't mess about with annoying Q, straight off the bat, pre-titles. He steals his boat, his retirement boat, which is a weird retirement boat to go fishing on, isn't it? It doesn't seem practical to fish in that boat. Yeah, just a little summary of him. In The Spy Who Loved Me, that's when he's referred to again as Major Boothroyd in dialogue. And so with, these scenes, he normally takes a day or two to film them. And then he's called back, obviously, for each one. So talking about favourite gadget, he said, I haven't got one. I mean, they've got so many wonderful gadgets. I suppose it would be a car. I can't think of anything else. You see, I loathe gadgets. I'm absolutely useless with them. I haven't got a mobile telephone. I haven't got a computer. I wouldn't know how to work one or anything like that.
That's just what you want, isn't it?
Keep that under his hat.
Oh dear. He also appeared in some of the video games. Not the voice though, just his likeness. Tomorrow Never Dies, World Is Not Enough, Nightfire, 007 Racing, and the James Bond 007 from Russia With Love. His likeness was in that, in all of those. So Desmond Llewellyn himself was born 12th of December 1914. And he was born in South Wales, and his parents wanted him to be a chartered accountant. That bored him. He wasn't interested. So he considered several professions, and he decided on a stage career. And he enrolled to RADA at the age of 20, where he was there for 2 years. He said, I tried the church, and that failed. I was too dim for accountancy, too short-sighted for the police force, and an insufficient liar to make a good politician. What else was left but to become an actor? I remember Richard Burton saying to me years later that the reason there are so many Welsh actors is because the church is not very popular nowadays. One of his fellow students at RADA was Geoffrey Keane, who obviously we saw in the Bond films, Bond alumni.
He plays the Minister of Defence, isn't he?
Mm, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
While he was at RADA, he made his film debut in a Gracie Fields film, Look Up and Laugh. That was in 1935. His first actual job after leaving RADA was for a theatre company in Southend. And then after that, he went on to appear in a play at Bexhill, where he met Pamela Pantlin, who he married in 1938. Then his film career started, and he was in a comedy called Ask a Policeman. But then that career was abruptly cut short because of the Second World War. And he served as a second lieutenant in the Royal Welsh Fusiliers. He was actually captured. Did you know this? He was captured by German soldiers in France, and he spent 5 years as a prisoner of war.
Wow, no way.
Yeah, but he was actually allowed to participate in acting roles with other prisoners. Mm. The German guards were fine with it. They thought it was good for morale. So he actually participated in the world premiere staging of Noel Coward's Postmortem with fellow prisoners in 1942.
Wow.
So then after the war, he resumed his film career with a war film, just what you want, called They Were Not Divided in 1950, directed by Terence Young. So
here we go.
So he, at the time of getting the role of Q, he'd been appearing in regional theatre, playing small film roles. He had four lines in Cleopatra in 1962. So in terms of Bond, he was asked who he considered the best Bond, best actor. And he said Sean Connery was perfect. George Lazenby played it straight and rather well. Roger Moore was much lighter and more jokey. It was a rather camp portrayal with a lot more emphasis on humour, but it worked. Timothy Dalton was Ian Fleming's Bond, a real character. His confidence and surliness were straight from the books. It was brave, but people didn't like it. Pierce Brosnan is extremely good. He has the right look and manner. So it sounds like fence sitting to me.
Very much so. I think what he said about Connery probably is the most praise.
Perfect.
And Dalton. Yeah, I mean, perfect.
Damn it, Llewellyn. Pick a Lynn. Use one of those giant fingers and select the best Bond.
So obviously after The World Is Not Enough, in terms of his private life, prior to in the 90s, his wife had suffered from Alzheimer's. So he was obviously, that was taking a toll personally for him. So just touching on his career, the rest of his career, he was in Lavender Hill Mob. He's also had a small role in Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. There's another mention of Chitty Chitty Bang Bang there, which was written by Ian Fleming.
Yeah.
Operation Kid Brother.
Yeah.
Oh.
Of course. Yeah.
Back to that already.
Of course, yeah. But sadly, on the 19th of December 1999, he was driving home from a book signing and his car collided head-on with another car in East Sussex. He sustained massive injuries and was airlifted to Eastbourne General Hospital, where he died quite soon afterwards, and he was 85. It only occurred 3 weeks after the premiere of The World Isn't Enough, so very sad.
Very sad.
Yeah, it's strangely, it's like it's the first, The World Isn't Enough was the first Bond film I saw in the cinema. I was a smidge too young to see it, but we'll not get into that. But Desmond Llewellyn is like the first like movie star death. Like I remember being like really saddened by it because I'd seen The World's Not Enough and I don't know, like I was young enough at the time to, like, to sort of go, oh, so that's why he went out for the film. It's like, they didn't know this was good. It was a weird sort of backwards sort of like, oh, it's strange that like, it was so strange that there's that poignant end that I didn't really process when I was watching it. And it happened and it was just all the sadder a few weeks later. Somehow, like, I was 9 years old, I should say, for context. Probably too young to see this in the cinema, but it.
Incredibly poignant, that final scene now.
Oh, yeah, it really is. He sort of disappears into the ground, doesn't he? It's kind of.
You're not retiring anytime soon. Are you?
Now, pay attention, 007. I've always tried to teach you two things. First, never let them see you bleed.
And the second?
Always have an escape plan.
Roger Moore, who obviously was with Desmond Llewellyn for six of his seven Bond films, he spoke at the funeral on the 6th of January 2000. His widow, Pamela, she died in 2001. Also, she was aged 85. And sadly, his son, Justin, died in 2012, aged 59.
Oh.
So there we go. What a career he had. Iconic. So iconic.
Yeah. Like I said, a staggering, towering figure over the Bond films.
Yeah. Full on the longest serving character of all, really, outlasted any Bond. Any other, like, you know, M and Moneypenny change hands throughout the course of his run. But, yeah.
And also such a great champion of Bond.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Really happy to talk about it and be involved and like do other stuff for Bond.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
There's quite a lot of like adverts of him reprising the character, isn't it? Whether it's to replace, like whether it's to promote a film or whether it's just in between, because again, that's just his place in pop culture. Everyone knows now. Pay attention, 007.
Yeah.
I think we understand each other.
Grow up, 007.
Coffee? Medium sweet. Two, medium sweet.
Thanks for listening. We hope you're enjoying the James Bond A to Z podcast. Remember, if you want to support the show, we have a coffee page at ko-fi.com/JamesBondA to Z, where you can buy us a coffee for just £3 or for £3 a month. Thanks for listening. Back to the show.
Is that all it does?
Before we move on to the next section, let's have a quick chat about the gadgets of the Bond films of the 1960s and 70s. And we'll do this throughout the podcast, have a look at the different eras. But if you had to choose sort of your favourite gadget from the 60s and 70s from the Bond films, what would your first thoughts go to, Brendan?
The attaché case. Straight to the attaché case. For me, it's so realistic and effective. And it's not jarring to the plot, you know. It's used in a believable way, which a lot of gadgets aren't. And
the setup and payoff is so good. You know, it does exactly what it's supposed to and trips up Red Grant as it does. But it's the sort of gadget that, you know, has plenty of, it uses the stuff that's in it all the way through in the film as well. And it's the sort of gadget that if it comes to it, you could just hit Red Grant with it if you really want to. It's not a single use thing like some of the gadgets we're going to talk about. It's like, now pay attention to 007. If you press this here, then the film will fall over just so. You know, it's practicality.
Yeah.
The thing, I think, like, there's a couple that I'd pick out, but the thing that I think I have to, the two that I would say I have to call out, the sat-nav in the Aston Martin in Goldfinger, just because it's sat-nav in the 1960s. Like, you know, talk about these films being 5 minutes in the future, like, wow, that's a heck of a thing to just have there. And the other one, I think, just from the real world story behind it, is probably the rebreather in Thunderball, because it's the film that they made with cooperation of navies and stuff, of the Navy. And they said, in return, you have to tell us how this rebreather, which gives you 4 minutes of air, that size, works. And they had to go, well, it doesn't. It doesn't actually work. It's not functioning. Like, the oxygen tank that's 100 times its size only lasts 40 minutes. So it's just a prop.
Wow, has that really happened? No way.
There was a story. Yeah, there was a story that during the cooperation, the producers were asked, like, "So, how does the rebreather work?"
That's ridiculous. I mean, for me, if I had to choose a favourite Bond gadget from the 60s, 70s, I think the Aston Martin DB5 and the Lotus Esprit. I think they're sort of the pinnacle for me. I mean, they're just absolutely outrageous in concept and design and execution. And I guess it's also a visual effects thing as well that makes them stand out. But if I had to choose one specific gadget in itself, I really like the Seagull snorkel from Goldfinger. Because when we spoke to Jeremy Dunn's back in the day, he'd found that the Seagull snorkel was based in reality. There was a plan in the World War II, I think, and it was supposed to be like a dead dog, I think, that they were supposed to use as the decoy sort of cover.
Less good in the water, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So I love that one as well. But, I mean, there's so many in the 60s and 70s, so many iconic ones. And it's where the 60s, 70s, you get the gadget watches start coming through, don't they? Mm-hmm. And that then becomes a staple of the series. If you're going to choose the sort of the worst, most stupidest ones, what would your mind go to?
Well, I just had an honourable mention for one that I like that's not really mentioned. But every time I see it, I'm like, the fake fingerprints. How effective that is.
Yeah.
It's great. That's so simple and effective.
Yeah.
Just a shame.
Is that in Diamonds Are Forever, that one?
Yeah. It's just a shame it's in Diamonds Are Forever.
Yeah, well, but Diamonds Are Forever is also the one that has the pocket mouse trap at the beginning, which is just full on Tom and Jerry. Like when he's cornered Blofeld, it's just the henchman just sticks his hand in the pocket, and there's just a mouse trap. Deeply silly.
I mean, there's a lot of stupid ones, isn't there? In the 60s and 70s, and one we talked about recently, Brendan, the Bondola.
Well, that's what I've got as my worst. Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry, I've stolen your thunder there.
Yeah.
I mean, there's function to that. If you're in a gondola, you never know when you're going to be chased by a gondola bastards and forced to go up on land when you're James Bond. It's just... But no, I'm not going to die on this hill, actually.
Too late.
Nope, I've made it off. I've miraculously made it off. I had a jet. Cigarette rocket launcher, I don't like. It's just naff. It's the opposite of what I'm talking about with Grant. It's just a thing of, like, you have to be able to aim it just so you have to be able to go, oh, can I, before you kill me, can I have a cigarette? And they have to go, yes, Mr. Bond. And it starts happening.
Yeah.
And you want to do it twice and going from there. The actual answer, though, is the prosthetic nipple, which he asks Q to make for him. Like, this is going to be the nadir of Q's profession. Korea. It's like, all right, we've been working on laser watches, we've been working on cars with ejector seats and that. This pervert I work with wants me to make him a prosthetic nipple. He's just sent me a drawing of what he wants it to look like, and he wants me to make that. And then at the end of it, when he uses it and he goes and poses as Scaramanga, like, at the end, he takes it off and just throws it in a bush.
Yeah.
He puts no value on poor Q's work at all.
I'd love to have seen the scene of Q actually making that nipple.
This should have been a question in the comments. How much did that nipple cost the British taxpayer?
And whose nipple is it modelled on? Did it, is it Q looking in the mirror? Getting it just right.
I mean, it puts the dart gun from Moonraker in context a little bit later, because it just seems to be there for a one-off the wrist joke. He's just calling him a wanker.
Yeah.
I mean, Moonraker's got some ridiculous gadgets. It's got that's the one with the exploding, what are they called? Bowlers? Is that what he calls them? Balls, 007. Yeah. That's a very specific gadget there.
And then it's got bollocks gadgets even before they go into space.
Yeah. Right, let's have a look at some of the other cues that have cropped up in the series. I'll kick things off with Casino Royale 67. So you've got Jeffrey Belden as Q. Now, do you remember this scene?
Yeah, it's sort of I've been served. Well, I suppose prefix Kingsman, doesn't it? It's kind of in a department store, is that right?
It's underneath Selfridges, yeah. And when they shot the scene, there was supposed to be a scene that preceded it where it was shown that the lab was underneath Selfridges. That scene never got shot because it's Casino Royale.
No.
And so when they come out of the lift and they say so, there's a joke about it being Selfridges, and it kind of falls a little bit flat. But yeah, and it's with Peter Sellers as Evelyn Tremble. So you've got him coming into the Q's lab, and being walked through. And it's it's actually a very good parody of the Q scene, even though the Q scenes had only really been going for three films. They absolutely nail the parody. It's one of the few parts of Casino Royale that nails, is a good parody of a James Bond film.
Yeah. It's by the time it gets to Roger Moore, it's almost ripping off that scene.
Well, it's funny you should say that, because let me just talk you through what happens in the Casino Royale 67 set. So there's a bit with men in wetsuits and they're firing bow and arrows. There's a karate chopping man who like karate chopping through blocks. And then when he salutes Bond, he karate chops himself in the head, knocks himself out. There is a bit with an exploding hat as well, where the hat is supposed to, I think it's supposed to shoot something off, but instead just ends up blowing up this guy's head. But there is a bit at the end, and there's a second character who's Fordyce, played by John Wells, who later went on to play Dennis Thatcher in Few Eyes Only. Anyway, in that bit, there's a demonstration of a gadget, and it's a pen. And they make a joke, or Evelyn Tremble, Peter Sellers, makes a joke about saying, oh, well, that would be perfect if I'm going to write a poison pen letter for someone. And both Q and Fordyce both like roll their eyes, shake their head at that's a dreadful joke. That's what everyone says. Why would you say that? And then Roger Moore actually uses that joke about a pen in Octopussy.
Now, take a fountain pen.
Twist the top. And a highly concentrated mixture of nitric and hydrochloric acid dissolves all metals.
Wonderful for poison pen letters.
Pay attention, 007.
It's beyond parody. So, yeah, I mean, like I said, they never shot the scene in Harrods, so it kind of doesn't make a little bit of sense. But talking about it later, Jeffrey Belden said, Sellers was in a marvellous mood. The point of the thing was to prove that the HQ of All Spies was in the basement of Harrods. Not Selfridges, sorry, Harrods. I went to see the film with a friend and we were wondering why everybody wasn't laughing. Our scene was halfway through the film and by then no one was laughing at anything. It was a very good scene, but it suffered from the fact that it was in the wrong place at the wrong time. Some of it was appallingly wrong. And Baildon, I don't know if you know the name, but he was a Shakespearean actor. He's best known for playing Catweasel. And he also turned down the chance to be the first Doctor in Doctor Who as well, something he regretted for a lot of his life. He later also appeared in Wurzel Gummidge as well. He was another World War II veteran who he was just very famous for playing roles that were a lot older than he actually was. And other things he was in later were All Creatures Great and Small, Tomorrow People. He did Doctor Who as well in the 70s. So he did finally get to play an alternative version of the Doctor in a audio play in 2003 and 2005. But yeah, that was Jeffrey Belden. And then John Wells, like I said, he was the guy playing Fordyce in that scene. And he went on to play Dennis Thatcher in For Your Eyes Only, having played Dennis Thatcher a number of times in a few different things, actually. So, yeah, I thought it was quite an interesting link. But, yeah, I mean, both Baildon and Wells are now dead. The other really famous cue is the Never Say Never Again cue. Now, this was played by Alec McCowan, and the character initially referred to as Q is then known as Algernon or Algie. And something I really like about Never Say Never Again, this is something we mentioned before, is how sort of rough and ready and down to earth the lab is in that film compared to the sort of the stagey version we get in the Bond films. And I think that's something they carry on through into the main Bond films when you get to the Dalton era. So I think that's always interesting about that. But yeah, I mean, you've got Q, he sort of takes Bond by surprise with his pen gun. He spends a lot of time complaining about cutbacks and his sinuses. and he expresses a wish to work for the CIA. And he also has that great line about the gratuitous sex and violence.
Good to see you, Mr. Bond. Things have been awfully dull round here. Bureaucrats running the old place, everything done by the book. Can't make a decision unless the computer gives you the go-ahead. Now you're on this. I hope we're going to have some gratuitous sex and violence.
Well, I certainly hope so too.
And then he has the joke about the Vicks inhaler, where again, you know, he says, what's this? And he says, it's an inhaler for my sinuses. Another joke, which is later stolen in the Brosnan era with the sandwich.
So that's my lunch.
That's exactly. But McCowan was a really, really acclaimed actor. And I know in Never Say Never Again, Connery really pushed to get the best actors in the best role. Roles. And McCowan really was that. His obituary in The Guardian called him an actor of dazzling technical brilliance whose career encompassed the classics, new plays, two remarkable one-man shows and an abundance of TV and film. And he was famously the lead in Alfred Hitchcock's Frenzy in 1972 and also the film Travels with My Aunt. He's another RADA veteran. Yeah, he also starred in the film The Loneliness of the Long Distance Runner. Speaking about the film Never Say Never Again in 2011, he said that the script changed the very day he arrived on set. He'd studied the script for months beforehand and the scene set in his mind, but the director, Irving Kirshner, had a last-minute script change. But when McCowan discussed the script change with Connery, the Bond star replied, "Don't worry about the damn script, Alex. Do the scene any way you want. I'll take care of Kirshner." So you can see he was calling the shots on that film. McCowan, sadly, he died in 2017, age 91. But yeah, a couple of other takes on Q there. Interesting how they sort of influenced the other versions of Q later on. Shall we talk about the best the best and worst gadgets of the 1980s and 90s?
Yes.
Right.
What have you got? Well, from looking at it, I found it very difficult, actually. That's like thinking, oh, these are all awful. But in Living Daylights, the sniper gun, and it's mainly because of the way Dalton handles it. You know, he looks fantastic when he's got that. The exploding pen in GoldenEye as well. I think they're probably the two stand out for me.
Yeah, classic.
Yeah, that's a good setup and payoff one again, the exploding pen. I mean, for me, from GoldenEye, it's always going to be, it's a background thing. It's the phone box that's just, the phone box that's just there randomly. Some poor lab tech answers it unwittingly and an airbag comes up and just... It's just another one of those background things you expect them to say, yes, I've read it for the ambassador's telephone or whatever he says. But for the best one for me would be, it's the Ericsson JB988, Bond's first ever mobile phone from Tomorrow Never Dies. With its fingerprint scanner, its taser, the remote control for the car. You know, you mentioned Doctor Who there, like it's phone as sonic screwdriver. It's just sort of this gadget that does whatever you need it to, but... It's I guess, a landmark in the series, just as the first mobile phone, really. It's sort of the first tip towards... Because they sort of carry this on, don't they, like with the subsequent mobile phones, to start making real-life features of new phones, kind of like gadget features. Like Quantum of Solace has a big thing about facial recognition in photographs and stuff like that. But it's just an interesting update really. I mean, for the 90s ones, I think for the 80s, it's a thing of you've got two films that sort of like go beyond the usual rules of James Bond films. So you have Field Q handing out stuff like an alarm clock, guaranteed never to wake up anyone who uses it, so that then doesn't wind up like playing into the plot. But the 90s kind of follows on with like, it's again, it's got some retro stuff. It kind of comes in GoldenEye with like a grappling belt, like straight out of like the 1989 Batman sort of, like it's sort of, because there hasn't been a film out since then. All right, we better get him a grappling gun. But I think the form stands out in that, especially the way that Q's introducing it.
Yeah, definitely.
Definitely. If I had to pick a sort of 80s, 90s, I quite like the ones he gets in License to Kill. So you've got the Dentonite toothpaste, which feels very grounded and realistic. And then you've also got the cigarette packet, sort of, which he uses as a detonator. Got to get those cigarette adverts in there somehow. So might as well get them in. But obviously another car, the Aston Martin V8 in The Living Daylights. Again, just another stunning sort of piece of visual effects and fantasy, I think, that really converges well in that movie. Love it. Love it a lot.
Can I have an honourable mention for the Vanquish, because I always, and every time I revisit it, right, I'm like, it's not as bad. It's like, it's an invisible car, sure, but it makes sense and it's fine.
Yeah. I mean, technically it's 2002, so it's not in the 90s, but I'm going to lump it in this era. So you can have that.
It's in there, yeah. I was going to say, I think the invisible car is really more about the execution than the idea itself. It's the cringy bits of Die Another Day and the CGI and the...
Yeah.
They go with a Vanish pun. They go there and they really over-egg it. Like, just throw that away. You don't need to step on it as hard as you used to.
Right. What about the worst, most ridiculous ones? Where to start? Can I start?
Well, yeah, go for it.
Yeah.
The iceberg submarine from Evie to a Kill.
Oh my god, I forgot about the iceberg submarine from Evie to a Kill.
I mean, yeah, okay, that's fine. How often are you going to need an iceberg submarine?
I just imagine Q in his lab tinkering with that. What am I doing?
At some point, he's just going to stop and go and like realize, oh no, James Bond's going to have sex in this, isn't he? I'm creating yet another sex bot for James Bond, that pervert I work with.
Yes, I will put the champagne chiller in it, James. Please, when I finish, it'll go in last.
I mean, well, that's the answer. Sorry, that is the answer. You've taken the heat off of me, because, as I said, The World Is Not Enough is the first one I saw, and I've got a soft spot for it. So I struggle to say that it's the avalanche-proof court, even though it's the avalanche-proof court. But it's a funny visual. What it is, it's a phone box. It's a phone box. It's a background stupid one that's elevated to being a main plot point in the film. Like, it's a really funny visual to watch the court blow up and balloon around.
Yeah.
There's all sorts of uses for that. You could jump out of windows. That's nice, softly. Like, I love the idea of it. It's just weird that it's as big a plot point as it is. So I struggle to say it's the worst, but with the iceberg submarine, you've taken the heat off me. My actual choice was going to be the keychain from Living Daylights.
That's harsh.
Because I think it's just the thing of, it's, you know, there's the tomorrow's worldification of some of these gadgets. It's like, oh, let's see what little bit of knick-knack we can just like stick like some explosives in. You know, it's like, it's the opposite of being current. You know, the background gag in that one is, we call it a ghetto blaster with the rocket launcher stereo. I mean, sorry, I missed out in the best one. Another great background one is the collapsing sofa, like the man-eating sofa thing, which is, again, perfect side gag.
But it's weird because when the collapsing sofa happens, it just makes you think of Live and Let Die with the exploding sofa. So there's like two gadget sofas in James, like, what? How?
There's a special branch. There's DFSQ. I just had a Q on the end there. On the keychain, though, there's the thing of like the tortured thing of, oh, you have to whistle Rule Britannia and it blows off. Just tortured. Like, I've just recently got a puppy. I can't always whistle to him. What if your mouth's dry? That is useless. What if you're like off key? What if you can't? I think it's a useless gadget, and I think it's packed into like a random 80s knickknack. I don't
and
like
it. It's used a lot as well, isn't it?
It is sure used is. A lot. Yeah. It's really only got two uses, and they really, it really feels like they use it a lot.
Why have we not mentioned the identigraph then?
Oh, yeah.
That is awful. Like, it's astonishingly bad. Like,
yeah.
It doesn't look anything like a human.
And surely the nose parameters would have a limit, right?
They spent so long on it that like Q's secretary brings them a cup of tea while they're doing it. It's like, oh, thank you, Sharon. And then, again, yeah, if we want to talk about Tomorrow's World, it's like, this is how they'll be able to do it in the future. It's like, nope, absolutely not.
But they also turn it on itself, don't they? Because then Zorin has a version that he uses on Bond, doesn't he?
Yeah, his
whatever that is.
His little Mega Drive thing. Just facial recognition.
Any other bad ones, Brendan?
Well, the X-ray specs into the world is not enough.
Yeah.
Because the majority, he just uses it to be a sex pest, really.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's just, I mean, a bit creepy.
There's another one where he's using the camera. What is he? He uses the camera to zoom in on the cleavage, doesn't he? And that is that Octopus. Oh,
that's a Roger Moore one. Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
I've got some bad ones for you.
Yeah.
So I was going to mention the bagpipes in The World Is Not Enough. That's a sort of a background sight gag. Mm-hmm. Again, how often is that going to come in useful? Actually, I quite like this one. There's two in both Timothy Dalton films. There's jokes around gadget rakes. Have you noticed this? One is a metal detector, and then the other one is a radio transmitter. Again, it's quite bizarre.
Yeah, Field Q in his terrible disguise as well just throws away at the end of the scene.
Throws his mustache off, doesn't he?
How much did that mustache cost the British tax? Never mind.
It's from the same team that made the nipples. I'd say actually a good one that I do like is the signature gun, which is the Timothy Dalton one, isn't it? That only he can use. I think that's quite a good one. But I mean, most of the terrible gadgets come from Octopussy. You know, you've got the rope climb, you've got the crocodile submarine.
The crocodile is awful.
the rocket-powered tuk-tuk, Hugh's hot air balloon. It's just a silly, silly movie.
Do you know why they're so bad? It's because it's based off the stuff that was good during the 60s with the Connery era, ramped up, turned up to 11 and got nonsense. Like the crocodile is basically the duck on the head.
Yeah.
Isn't it? But nonsense.
But actually that sparked off a thought. Is it there's the one in is it License to Kill where Timothy Dalton wears like a manta ray sort of diving cover thing or disguises himself as a manta
ray. I like that.
That's a good one.
Yeah. That makes sense, doesn't it?
Yeah, but the crocodile is ludicrous. Yeah. And the fact that Q kept it, recovered it from the field so that he could show it off in Die Another Day is kind of absurd.
Well, I have issues with that scene in Die Another Day anyway. How did they get Rosa Klebb's shoe?
Yeah.
Strange.
Well, that's the 80s and 90s. But let's move into the noughties and meet the new Q, Brendan.
New Q.
I'm your new quartermaster.
You must be joking.
Why, because I'm not wearing a lab coat?
Because you still have spots.
My complexion is hardly relevant.
Well, your competence is.
Age is no guarantee of efficiency.
And youth is no guarantee of innovation.
I'll hazard I can do more damage on my laptop sitting in my pyjamas before my first cup of Earl Grey than you can do in a year in the field.
Oh, so why do you need me?
Every now and then a trigger has to be pulled.
We didn't have a Q in Casino Royale and Quantum of Solace. So, yeah, Skyfall, we have Q played by Ben Whishaw. And he was only 31 at the time. And that meant it was the first time that the actor playing Q was younger than the actor playing Bond. Obviously, there's that scene where they meet in front of the painting at the National Gallery.
Great scene.
Fantastic scene. And Bond obviously is shocked at how young Q is. But you can see there's a mutual respect that is pretty instant, actually. So they're simple gadgets for Skyfall, and yeah, that's where you get that line from Q, where you're expecting an exploding pen. You don't really go in for that anymore. Zinger on GoldenEye there. How dare you?
No, yeah. They got all the way back to 1995 to zing a Bond from 1995. It should have been, we don't really go in for crocodiles anymore. We don't really go in for
invisible cars. Bondlers.
Yeah. Bondlers.
But this version of Q still gets frustrated with Bond and his lack of care about taxpayers' money. Inspector Q injects Bond with smart blood, which allows MI6 to track him. But Q is obviously heavily involved in the plot to help Bond disappear.
Q in the field.
Field Q. Field Q. No Time to Die. We also get Field Q. Field Q in his pajamas.
Well, isn't that a reference to him saying that he can cause more havoc in his pajamas in Skyfall? I think it's a callback.
Yes.
But also, they also said that, did he get him out of bed? So I think the two are linked, sort of. It's a nice, I think it's nice.
And I love the callback.
Yeah, I love the little bit on the carrier where he's like looking through drawers of guns and stuff, and there's just a nice drawer with like some kitchenware, just teapots. Like, whoops. Yeah. Just got to say it again. Lovely.
So in No Time to Die, it is implied that Q is gay when Bond and Moneypenny interrupt him preparing a romantic dinner. And Ben Whishaw recently had some comments on this, and he said, I don't feel it was forced upon the studio. That was not my impression of how it came about. I think it came from a good place. But he said he had concerns about the scene during a chat with Barbara Broccoli. And he said he thought at the time, are we doing this? And then we're doing nothing with it. I remember perhaps feeling that was pretty unsatisfying. For whatever reason, I didn't pick it apart with anybody on the film. Maybe on another kind of project I would have done, but it's a very big machine. I thought a lot about whether I should question it. Finally, I didn't. I accepted this was what was written, and I said the lines, and it is what it is. So there you go. I mean, I remember at the time I watched it and I thought it was done quite well, but
tastefully.
Yeah.
It's throwaway because it's normal. It's just normal life, you know. You get more about Q, like kind of just in bits and bobs, like in Skyfall. It's just like nice touches, like him having the Scrabble mug, like with the Q. It's just little touches of personality that sort of build up. Like I think he more than the other characters in that sort of MI6 family throughout these three films, like benefits the most from the grace notes rather than the, you know, I think by the time of No Time to Die, you have to give Ray Fiennes something to play, for instance. But I can't remember where we fell on this because I was on the No Time to Die episode. Do you think he'll be back as Q? Like, do you think he could do the Desmond Llewellyn, even if they change everything else, keep him on?
Well, he said, I have absolutely no idea. I know nothing. They are incredibly tight-lipped about everything, really. I have a suspicion I won't be coming back. I think they'll probably start all over again, and that might be the right thing. But of course, I don't know for certain.
I interviewed Ben Whishaw for No Time to Die, and I asked him because I think him, Naomi Harris, Ralph Fiennes signed three picture deals when they signed up. So their deals are expired. Whether they'll carry on, I would like to think they will do. I feel like it adds. I don't know. It kind of feels like what Cubby would do. And I feel like that's something they often look to.
Well, Cubby wouldn't kill Bond, so.
Well, let's not start that. Let's not start that conversation again.
He's certainly the one of this current era. Like, I'm really not fussed about seeing Ralph Fiennes as M again, because I feel like it really overbalanced the last film, trying to find something for him to do.
Yeah.
And inadvertently really making him the real villain of the piece.
Yeah.
There's that, but like I could easily see him, you know, in the same way as like Llewellyn's role changes when he is opposite different Bonds, and you know, you have Judi Dench as an entirely different M, because she can't be the same M from the President films. It doesn't work. It's one of those things that I can imagine if the next one's going to be very different. If they go a bit lighter, then they can have a character who's quite funny anyway. Like Wisho's Q is quite funny.
Yeah.
Throughout those three films.
And I think you're right, actually, what you were saying about how he was M was overbalanced in No Time to Die. I know we've done episodes on M and Moneypenny recently, and I think on both of those, we sort of agreed that they'd painted them into a corner with how much further they could do, because by inflating the size of their characters and developing them so far, that by then asking them to take a step back next time round just sort of doesn't really make sense. Whereas Q has always had a similar sort of size role in every movie, that it kind of would make sense for Q to be the one to carry on if the others do change, because they're not going to move him on. There's not much more to move him on. He's not like never been a badass in the field. He's never like, you know, gone like ups, like done a treasonous thing like M did in the last film. I think I think Q has the cleanest slate to work from.
Yeah. My only issue with it is Ben Whishaw is a pretty big deal now, and Desmond Llewellyn wasn't outside of Bond.
Yeah, but is he though? I mean, have you got more notes on his career?
Yeah, I'm going to do his career. Paddington. I'm like, come on. The best film ever made. So, you know, the two best films ever made. And if they get the third one right, it's going to be a perfect trilogy. Just want to, you know, put that out there. So Ben Whishaw was born in 14th of October, 1980. Now, his paternal grandfather was born Jean-Vladimir Stelmacher. And he lived in Germany, but he changed his name to John Victor Whishaw after World War II because he served as a British spy in the German army. I thought that was quite interesting. So there is a link to spies. But Ben Whishaw himself, he was a member of the Bancroft Players Youth Theatre. And then he attended RADA. So again, we've got another RADA alumni. He graduated in 2003. He was the lead in Trevor Nunn's production of Hamlet in 2004 at the Old Vic, and that's where he received very favourable reviews, and he was nominated for an Olivier for Best Actor. He was actually named Most Promising Newcomer in the British Independent Film Awards for My Brother Tom as well. So from quite a, you know, his early 20s, he's making a name for himself. He also appeared as one of the Bob Dylan reincarnations in I'm Not There in 2007. He, at the end of 2009, he starred in Cock, which was a new play by Mike Bartlett, and that was at the Royal Court Theatre. It's about a gay man who falls in love with a woman. He was in The Hollow Crown. Either of you seen this? He played Richard II.
Had a big starry cast, didn't it?
Huge cast.
Cumberbatch, yeah. Hiddleston.
Yeah. Yeah. And he won a BAFTA for leading actor for that. So in 2012, obviously he became Q, but he was also in Cloud Atlas. And when he made Skyfall, it was the fourth time he'd worked with Daniel Craig after they'd been together in The Trench, Enduring Love and Layer Cake.
Oh, it's a long time since I've watched Layer Cake, but yeah, is he not the boyfriend who sort of, spoilers for Layer Cake, is he not the guy who shoots him at the end?
Ooh.
I might be thinking of somebody else. It's a long time since I've seen Layer Cake.
Spring 2013, he was on stage with Judi Dench in a play called Peter and Alice, written by John Logan, who has written for Bond films.
Skyfall, yeah.
And then in 2014, this is where everything changes. He starred as Paddington, Paddington Bear, in the film Paddington, where they actually motion captured his expressions as well.
Is that right?
Yeah, which I just thought they put his voice on it. But yeah, he actually stepped in when...
Colin Firth.
Yeah, Colin Firth had recorded all the dialogue, hadn't he?
Yeah.
But it just didn't fit.
He's too old, isn't he?
Yeah, I can't imagine that.
It's not the right voice, is it?
No.
And they thought the same. So did he as well, actually. He agreed. And then in 2017, he came back and had another stab at it. In Paddington 2, with Hugh Grant in that one, which is excellent, by the way. I recommend you go and seek out both of those.
And friend of the show, Sanjeev Bhaskar.
Yes. And then in 2018, he starred alongside Hugh Grant again. He played Norman Scott, and Hugh Grant played Jeremy Thorpe in A Very English Scandal, which also is on iPlayer and is excellent.
Absolutely terrific.
There is, it's worth seeking out. This, I think, it's the year, a year in the life of a year that had it. Like, it's one of those end of the year, like, roundup things that swaps the dialogue from the trial scene in Paddington and the trial scene in A Very English Scandal, because Hugh Grant and Ben Whishaw are in both.
Oh, very
and,
nice.
And those words going out that little bear's mouth is quite a spectacle.
I can imagine. He also starred as Michael Banks in Mary Poppins Returns.
Yes.
Yeah.
And in 2020, he had a lead role in the fourth season of Fargo, alongside Chris Rock, Jason Schwartzman. And then more recently, he's been in This Is Going to Hurt, which is an adaptation of Adam Kay's memoirs, being a junior NHS doctor. Wishaw was also the executive producer for that as well. So that's his career up to this moment. And, you know, he's, I would say he's got more of a career that I'm aware of outside of Bond than Desmond Llewellyn did.
Yeah. But true, but so does Judi Dench. And Judi Dench did keep coming back in between other things. You know what I mean? It's not like if you keep him on a Llewellyn style, you know, if you don't make him as integral to the plot as he is in some of these recent ones, you can have him pop up for a scene.
Well, yeah, that's the problem, isn't it? That's the problem. If they carry on this sort of Marvel Avengers style where they need the whole team there, then you're going to need them for longer than 2 to 3 days shooting, aren't you?
Yeah, let's hope not. Let's hope they don't carry on.
Yeah, I don't think anyone wants that.
No.
I think the first thing I remember seeing Ben Whishaw in or remembering him from was Nathan Barley. Do you remember that? And he played Pingu, the tech.
That was Chris Morris's show, wasn't it? Was it Chris Morris that wrote that?
Charlie Brooker.
Charlie Brooker as well. Yeah, that was someone else, yeah. But yeah, he was the tech wizard, wasn't he, that was terrorised by Nathan Barley. Great. I think Ben Whishaw's a terrific actor. He's got like a real sort of, he can do humour really well. There's sort of a real sense of vulnerability about him.
Mm.
Which is just, it's very soulful, I think, his style. And I think he's really good in the Bond films that he's been in. He gets a bit of a bum deal, I think. Is it Inspector?
Yeah, and everyone does.
Or is it Skyfall? Yeah, no, which is the one in Skyfall is the one where he really messes up, doesn't he? By putting the USB into his own laptop.
Oh, yeah, but then Skyfall kind of goes off a cliff about halfway through on that score anyway. Just it requires everyone to act stupid for a little while because this is what happened in The Dark Knight. Like, so we need to do.
Yeah,
we need to plug this USB in. And they even make a joke about it in No Time to Die where Bond just tips up to his flat with a USB and he just goes, do you know where this has been? rather than just plug it straight in.
Right, should we just talk about the gadgets before we move on to our final section?
Slim Pickens.
Yeah, of the noughties. So this is sort of post 2000 gadgets. Best choices?
Well, for best, I was going to ask, like, because I don't know if this character is referred to as a quartermaster or not, but in terms of gadgets, there's only really the bit where they turn up after Solange has been killed and Bond's injected with the tracking thing. I don't know if he's meant to be sort of a quartermaster type figure, but other than that, he just has like the car gets outfitted, and I think the field medical kit is the answer, isn't it, really, for this one?
It's the
best optional extra in a car ever. You need it to live in the scheme of that thing. And again, it's works in the plot, but it's multi-purpose. You can see why it's there. It's not really a really labored sell.
Yeah, I think I'd go for the signature gun, to be honest.
Yeah.
Simple but effective.
I think,
I'm going to choose cars again. I do like the fact that the DB5 comes back and it's been tricked out for No Time to Die. I think that's pretty cool. But yeah, I had the car defibrillator as well. I just think that's just such a great sort of Casino Royale-esque gadget, isn't it? It's useful. It takes it back to, you know, what we were saying about From Russia with Love. So, yeah, I mean, in worst ones of this era, are we going to include Die Another Day in this section? Because if we are, there's obviously a lot there to choose from. And chiefly the one for me is the virtual reality combat simulator in Die Another Day.
Oh, God. I've completely forgotten about that. That is really bad. I've just rewatched GoldenEye last week, and in that, like, reinventing Moneypenny the way they do is really well done. As a woman who reacts the way a man would if a slightly annoying colleague kept flirting with her and never acting on it, she flirts right back. And by Die Another Day, which has fully catapulted itself back into nostalgia, like, it's just a really cheap gag at the end there with her and the virtual reality thing.
Mm. Yeah. It is bad, but it's not as bad, in my opinion, as Smart Blood.
Of course, Smart Blood is the answer. That is Smart Blood.
Absolute nonsense.
Well, do you know where the genesis of this was? That apparently Sam Mendes sent John Logan some research when they were coming up with the early drafts. And the idea was going to be that, and you could cover this in the Spectre episode, I suppose, but like, just to quickly jump ahead on that, an early draft would have had the idea that a traitor in MI6, who would have turned out to be Tanner, downloaded all of MI6's data into Bond's blood. So the baddies are after Bond to get all the data out of his blood. Oh, and God, that fell away. But you know, somehow the Smart Blood angle still stayed in. It makes you like, because they do reference it in No Time to Die as well, but it's in there as the, no, he is definitely dead. Like, it's in there for that. But it's a thing of earlier on in the phone call, oh, we thought you must have died. We had no idea where you were. It's like, you do, though, because you've got GPS in his blood.
He has a tracker in, he has an implant in Casino Royale, doesn't he? And then he has the...
That they cut out. Yeah.
And then he has the Smart Blood in Spectre and then Smart Blood again in No Time to Die.
Yeah.
It's kind of a lot, isn't it?
For one era. It just seems to have like stayed in there in through draft after draft, even though they took out the thing about the data. But it's like, maybe I'm getting too far in ahead kind of here, but its actual usefulness in the plot is that it's clearly how Hinks and Blofeld know where he is all the time, because C's working for them. But they never connect that dot in the film. You just have to, and it's not in a way like, oh, we're not spoon-feeding you. It just doesn't come up. It's just, oh yeah, Smart Blood.
I think the issue is, right, he's a spy.
Yeah.
And no one should know where he is. Not even not even MI6 should know, because there always is somebody that's working for the other side.
A compromise, yeah.
So we're talking about a spy whose name, foibles, and favorite drink are known by everyone he meets, mostly because he introduces himself by his real name before he goes. And this is somehow worse than that for a spy. Like, yeah.
Well, I think that just about wraps up the chat about Q. I guess, I mean, we sort of covered about what next for Q. I'd like to see Ben Whishaw return. But yeah, I guess if people want to let us know what they want to see for the future of Q, they can email us at podcast@jamesbondaz.co.uk. And to wrap things up, Mark, you've prepared a quizling.
Yeah, Q is well, I've never known. That word, but curious for quiz. Yeah, I've got a quiz for you both if you'd like to indulge in that. Just on the advice of my my solicitors before we get started, I'm just going to say I've never even heard of Popmaster or of Ken Bruce or even of BBC Radio 2, so any similarity to person's events or quiz formats is entirely coincidental. I'm just going to go into Quizmaster mode, so prepare yourselves for that. Hello, welcome to Quartermaster, the very one-off 007 quiz show, where each of our contestants has 10 questions about Bond, James Bond, on-screen, off-screen, and all over the place. Each contestant will have a choice of two specialist subjects. Each correct answer they give me is worth 1 point, and the player with the most points at the end of the quiz wins. For the winner, I have the standard DAB digital radio, but if you look closely and twist this volume dial to the right, it turns into a portable rocket launcher that also blows women's tops off. For the runner-up, I have a pair of ordinary Bluetooth headphones that anyone can connect to, so depending on what century you're in, you might catch Bond doing sex noises, or you might pick up Christoph Waltz gloating about your girlfriend's sudden yet inevitable betrayal. In terms of conditions apply, contestants will not actually receive any prizes I've made up as cheap gags. Now, pay attention. First day is Brendan from Northampton. How are you, Brendan? Are you a big James Bond fan?
I am. I started a podcast about it.
Well, that's very good. You're going to get 10 questions. Each one is worth 1 point. Your specialist subject round, your bonus questions, will be worth 2 points for each correct answer. You have a choice now of specialist subjects. Would you like James Bonds or James Bond villains?
James
Bonds. So Bonds or Bond villains? Bonds, yes.
Yeah.
Okay. So the bonus round will come in the middle. And these aren't going to be timed, but I am going to ask you to give me an answer in a reasonable time. I will shout Roger's walking, which means you have 5 seconds, because that's roughly the amount of time in the opening gun barrels that Roger Moore takes by his last film to get to the middle of the screen and shoot you. Okay. Here we go, Brendan. Good luck. Here is your first question. Q is for Quantum of Solace. Though affected by the 2007-2008 writer's strike, Quantum of Solace is credited to Neil Purvis, Robert Wade, and which other returning Bond screenwriter?
Oh, no. Why is it a Quantum question?
Roger's walking.
Oh. I don't know.
That is Paul Haggis was the answer number one. Number two, Q is for Quitting. In what year did George Lazenby make his first and last appearance as Bond?
1969.
Correct. Question number three, Q is for Q Branch. In the Q Branch scene in GoldenEye, Pierce Brosnan inadvertently name drops a future theme song title. What is the name of the song? Name of that song that he names in GoldenEye? Bridge is walking.
Spectre?
It's not the name of the song. It's Writings on the Wall. He shows him the exploding pen and he says the writings on the wall. Number four, Q is for Q. Some of these subjects may have come up earlier in the episode, by the way. Q is simply for Q, Desmond Llewellyn in this case. In which 1968 Cubby Broccoli production does Desmond Llewellyn play a character called Mr. Coggins?
Chitty Chitty Bang Bang.
It is Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. On to your bonus questions now. Q is for quotes for the next three questions. You picked James Bond, so you're going to hear three quotes from James Bond in different films. All you have to do is tell me in which film Bond says each of these quotes. Each correct answer is worth 2 points. We just want the name of the film. So, question five. In which film does Bond say, that's just as bad as listening to the Beatles without earmuffs?
Goldfinger.
Correct. Number six. Maybe I'm Judge Stromberg. Any man who drinks Dom Perignon 52 can't be all bad.
Spy Love Me.
Correct. And question number seven. I'll do anything for a woman with a knife. Roger's walking.
Octopussy?
It's not. It's License to Kill. Just to Pam Bouvier.
Yeah, of course.
Back to regular questions. Q is for Quantum. What is the name of the opera that the Quantum lads go and see for their work night out at the Breggins Opera House?
What?
Right, just walking.
No, I don't know.
It's Tosca. Number nine, Q is for quarters, headquarters. Which James Bond film finds MI6 quartered on the wreck of the Queen Elizabeth II ocean liner? Roach is walking, and it's one of his, you'd be surprised to hear.
For Your Eyes Only?
It's The Man with the Golden Gun. And question 10, last question for this round. Q is for Quids In. Which of these films grossed more at the UK box office to date? Casino Royale or Quantum of Solace?
Casino Royale.
It is Casino Royale. Well done, Brendan. After that round, you have a total of 7 points.
Oh, boy.
Today's next contestant is Tom from Lincoln. Welcome to Quartermasters. Do you think you can top Brendan's performance in that round?
I think he did very well, but hopefully your questions will be a bit more forgiving for me, Mark.
They won't. You have 7 points to beat. Your specialist subject choices for your bonus round are Bond Girls or Bond Songs?
Oh, God. Bond Songs.
Bond Songs it is. Question number one in your general Bond questions. Q is for Q Branch. In the opening of The World Is Not Enough, Bond activates a detonator concealed inside what wearable accessory? Roger's walking.
A shoe.
It's his glasses.
Oh,
number two, Q is for Quist. Which Bond film features a spectre operative called Quist, played by God. Bill Cummings?
What? Quist, I know it. I know it. I can see him.
Roger's walking.
Oh, is it Thunderball?
It is Thunderball. Yeah, well done.
Away.
I just will check myself there for a second. Q is for Quantum. Which British comedy actor plays Guy Haynes, special envoy to the UK Prime Minister and secret member of Quantum in Quantum of Solace?
He died recently. His name's Paul. Oh, he's in Friday Night Dinner.
Roger's walking.
Oh, his name is something. The name escapes me.
It's Paul Ritter, the late great Paul Ritter. Number four, Q is for Q. This is another Desmond Llewellyn question. In which 1963 historical epic does Desmond Llewellyn play a senator serving a very different queen and country? This one was mentioned earlier in the episode.
Oh, is it Passport Pimlico?
It's not. It's Cleopatra.
Oh.
Q is for Quartz again. You picked Bond songs, didn't you? Yep.
Yeah.
So you're going to hear quotes from the lyrics of Bond songs. All you have to do is name the title of the song. We don't want the name of the film, the title of the song.
Okay.
So number five, which Bond song features the lyric, "All I wanted was a sweet distraction for an hour or two"?
Oh, it's All Time High?
Yes, it is. Well done. Number six, If That's All We Have, You Will Find We Need Nothing More, from which Bond song?
Can I hear it again?
If That's All We Have, You Will Find We Need Nothing More. Roger's Walking.
Or is it No Time to Die?
It's not. It's We Have All the Time in the World, which does feature in No Time to Die, of course. Number seven, I'll tease and tantalize with every line till you are mine. What's the name of the Bond song?
Oh. Diamonds Are Forever. Don't know.
It's Surrender from the end of Tomorrow Never Dies. You definitely picked the harder of the two specialist subjects on that one.
Wow.
I have to say, Tom. But between you, between the two of you, that's it for quarter. You've had your six. Whoop, one more there. Back to general knowledge questions, though. Question number eight. Q is for Queen and Country. What is the official title of the Danny Boyle-directed short featuring James Bond and Queen Elizabeth II parachuting into the 2012 Olympic opening ceremony?
Oh, it's called Pride and Glory?
It's not. It's called Happy and Glorious.
Ah, Happy and Glorious. It's close.
Number nine. Q is for Quarters, Headquarters. In which Bond film is the villain hiding out in St. Cyril's Monastery?
For Your Eyes Only.
It is For Your Eyes Only.
St. Cyril's.
And number 10, Q is for Quids In. Once again, which film has grossed more at the UK box office to date, Skyfall or No Time to Die?
No Time to Die. No, sorry, no, Skyfall.
I have to take your first answer. It is, in fact, Skyfall. done all right there, Tom. You got 4 points, but with 7 points, Brendan is today's winner.
Wow, there you go.
Prizes will not be given. Thank you for playing, Quartermaster.
Can I have a signed photo, please, Mark?
Oh, sorry, I'm back. How long was I out? Have we done the quiz?
Okay. That's it. I think that was brilliant, Mark. Thank you so much.
Okay, I look forward to hearing that.
Can I just say hello to everyone that knows me?
Yes, go on, you got 13 seconds.
This was fun, chaps.
Yeah, well, thank you so much for joining us, Mark, and thank you for listening. And just a little reminder, we want your favourite underappreciated James Bond movie moments for our anniversary special. You can record them, send them to us, make sure they're under 2 minutes in length. We want an audio clip. I've had some emails in with the list, but we want it as an audio clip. Send them to podcast@jamesbondaz.co.uk and then you could be on the show. But Brendan, where do people find us on social media?
At James Bond A to Z on Facebook, Instagram and Twitter.
Yes, so please follow us on there. Give us a like and subscribe on your podcast platform of choice. Mark, how do people find you?
Hey, you can follow me on Twitter. It's at mharrison90. I also write, I'm doing weekly Bond features at the time of recording to coincide with the cinema re-releases over on filmstories.co.uk. If you enjoyed the quiz bits, you can also follow Film Quiz Friday. There's a 30-question film quiz every Friday morning for you to have a go at there. Probably as difficult as that one was. I don't know what the other guy was doing for you there, but... what quiz hole quiz doing is there, but I'm back in the room, and as I say, enjoy those quizzes and Bond articles if you like.
Yeah, I mean, they might even be out by the time this you hear this, or if you're listening to this in the future, and they are terrific. I think Mark's got a very good analytical eye for Bond, so it's a pleasure to have you back, Mark. Hopefully we'll have you on again before the show reaches the letter Z.
Cheers, anytime.
So it just remains for me to say that the James Bond A to Z podcast will return next week, and we're talking Quantum of Solace. Thanks for listening.
Bye.
Ciao.
The James Bond A to Z podcast is hosted and produced by Tom Butler and Brendan Duffy, with music by Tom Ingemels and artwork by Helene Dolly. If you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe and leave us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Thanks for listening.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HourEnergy.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HourEnergy.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.